Okay. Welcome back, everyone. I want to thank you for your participation in Roz's case. And what I'd like to do right now is introduce Roz to you. Raza is an active
venue.
Can you all mute yourself,
Michael, would
please?
You be able to mute?
Raza is an active investor in early stage companies in New England and has been investing with Launchpad Venture since 2016. Raza is the managing partner of Beacon Venture Partners, a venture capital firm that invests in diversified basket of local early stage Boston area companies from the Launchpad portfolio. Raza's board experiences include technology startup. Raza and Joe Ayoub, who is with us today, are co-hosts of the On Boards podcasts, where they bring governance experts in for discussions. For those of you who have not been to the podcast, let me suggest it for you. It's www.onboardspodcast, onboardspodcast, On Boards Podcast. Raza co-founded North Bay, which is one of the largest independent Amazon cloud web service partners, helping large enterprises transition to the cloud. Previously, Raza was part of the MIT Harvard Broad Institute, building a large-scale science platform for small molecule synthesis. So thank you and welcome, Raza.
Larry, it's a pleasure.
What we're going to do is I'm going to go around. We have three groups, and I hope each group identified a spokesperson. Group one is Bill Asher, John, Mark, Marianne, Robert, and Susan. Is there a spokesperson for that group?
Yeah, John Bohenek.
So John, would you kind of give a summary of what your group decided?
Sure. It was great exercise for the team. I learned a lot in the process. So in summary, summarizing for the team, there's a lot of fundamental errors that were made in the, I guess, funding strategy and options for the company from the very start. So there's a high risk that the business wasn't going to be able to be successful. The company burned through a lot of cash. They had to bring in a new CEO. There's information we don't know, but it seems like the CEO may have lost the trust of the board. But there's also questions about the board's capacity and capability to oversee the company and drive it to some successful future. The company is definitely in crisis, so it's in a crisis managed situation. There was discussions based upon whether the CEO would be a part of that crisis management or not. The consensus was to keep the CEO on and use that person's expertise in the strategy to try to salvage the company. There's going to be a lot of paths that are going to be addressed in the next 2 to 4 months as the company is running out of cash. Those include looking at going back to the VC company, which to find out exactly why that fell through. Maybe that's salvageable. The other option was to look at different types of grants. These are all concurrent paths to move forward. The other was, could you find distribution that would be, exclusive distribution for a period of time that would incentivize someone to want to fund the business moving forward? And what the company has, besides a little bit of cash, is its assets. So the other concurrent path was to look at maybe a joint venture where this company brings in its assets and the other company brings in the cash, maybe Biogen or another. Those would all be concurrent paths to see which one made sense. The leads for all those would be divided between the CEO and the board members. At some period of time, this is a crisis management, so it's daily, weekly reviews. There's a decision made on what the best path forward is. If none of those are successful, the only thing the company has is assets. And then at the end, you see if you can find someone to pick up those assets at pennies on the dollars.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. Group two is Gay Bach, Joe, John, Mindy, Raza, and Stefan. Do you have a spokesperson?
Yep. So that would be me, Gay Bach. And we had a good conversation, I think, from having read the case. The first question we discussed was whether the board still had confidence in the CEO. And I think from reading through the case and the discussion concluded that it seemed that that had run its course. And so given that you've got 4 months of cash and the severance sounded like it would be a significant part of that severance. So we realized that but the board also believed in the technology. So we made the decision the board would have to pass the hat and sort of do another bridge in order to sort of work through and transition the CEO out, as well as be prepared to give up a fair amount of equity points to a new CEO. And that person is someone you'd be looking for who had a track record of being able to raise money. And I think that was sort of the possibility. If we couldn't find that person, then we were going to be in a world of hurt. But that was sort of where we landed it. Team, if I left anything important out, please let me know.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Team three, Angela Allen, Brian, John, Kevin, Michael, and Robert.
Hey, Larry, it's Brian. I'll take the lead on this. I'm going to help be benefited by Michael, our attorney. He's got some real depth and experience, because when we sized up the case, there was a lot going on, but we really said there was really two big issues. One is the employment challenge and the agreement with the CEO, and that truly needed to be addressed and cleaned up. And there's a lot of potential pitfalls there, given in the case they did share historically she had been litigious. So I'm going to let Michael comment on what that means and some thoughts to consider. But before I turn it over to him on that front, the second big issue was really just the overall lack of execution on value creation consistently for quite some time. So that's a big problem that even cleaning up the HR issues isn't going to rectify what's been going on for quite some time. And I think the board plays into that a bit, but it's also those that are within the firm that really haven't been executing. So really thoughts to address. We felt it was a cleanup on the HR issue. So I'm going to let Michael talk to that a little bit. And then secondly, we felt it best to reconfigure the company after we've addressed the cleanup, really have a new entity of sorts that we can now go out to strategics. And the way in which we could do that is a variety of ways, but all of that is for null if we can't really address the cleanup and dealing with the CEO, because nobody's going to want to be attracted to the IP or any of the value that may exist if it's got a lot of pitfalls associated with it. So, Michael, if you could be so kind and share your thoughts and insights, just given your background on some of the pitfalls associated with the HR and legal issues with how the agreement was signed with the CEO, that would be helpful for everybody. I think you're on mute, Michael.
Michael?
Is it just me or is Michael on mute?
Yeah, I'm back. You can all hear me now.
Yes.
I didn't know whether Raza knew this legal wrinkle and he put it in there deliberately or whether he stumbled upon something inadvertently. But the real legal wrinkle is the Massachusetts Wage Act. So the Massachusetts Wage Act, which has, you know, probably the most potent pro-employee, you know, weapon, is directly implicated here, and it has a number of consequences. One is that there is no way to make a legal deferral arrangement where you pay someone nothing for their time. And that's been, you know, established by, you know, by the federal courts and the state courts in Massachusetts. So because there was a deferral arrangement of all compensation that was cooked into the employment agreement, there's a big problem here. The Wage Act provides for three things. One is treble damages that are mandatory, not permissive, but mandatory. The recovery of attorney's fees, which is also mandatory, and individual liability, which extends beyond the corporation to those having the management of the corporation, which is the words of the statute, which is, I don't know, over 100 years old. So what does that do here? Once the CEO gets a sense that she is on the outs, and we know from the fact pattern that she's litigious, we assume she goes to a lawyer. A lawyer looks at her agreement and says, wow, you have a really you have a lot of leverage. You have a really strong Wage Act case. The way that you diminish the hurt of a Wage Act case is to make a tender of everything that is owed to the executive, not by way of severance. Severance does not fall under the Wage Act, but by paying all back wages that are due, by paying 12% in simple interest calculated from the date that payments had to have been made. And once you make that tender, and so long as you make that tender before a complaint is filed, under the prevailing authority, the plaintiff executive does not have the right to seek treble damages. So, you know, cleaning this up, you know, once you add into the fact pattern that she is litigious and she's had fights already with her former employer, then you can't count on her, you know, being adverse to litigation. And so the way to clean this up is to size up exactly what she's owed based upon what the deferral was, and to pay her without, you know, literally a check would be, or a wire would be cut for telling her that we have paid you your back wages, we've included statutory interest, and, you know, that diminishes her claim. Then you're stuck with just a standard, you know, are you going to terminate her for cause or without cause? I don't have the definitions of cause, but, you know, under a typical employment agreement, you know, you would hope that her continued, you know, persistent failures to succeed, her disregard of board directives, her going out on some of her own missions, all of that, you know, combined would give you a solid basis to terminate her for cause, provided that the employment agreement has a for-cause termination, in which case all she's owed is her accrued wages, meaning the wages that are due as of the time of termination. Certainly she could bring a claim, but if she had, since we know she has a pretty terrible track record, that claim is not going to be that compelling. So, you know, that's the HR cleanup here. And then, you know, once you get rid of her, I mean, she's still an investor, but, you know, once you get rid of her leverage, then, you know, we're dealing with straight business issues.
Yeah. And to that point, just be careful of time. I think that's what we need to reconfigure the company. And that could go in a variety of different ways. Do we get an additional few dollars from our board members or angel investors to then see if we can't go sell the assets, as opposed to just shut down the company and everybody go home with nothing? So that was kind of our high level assessment, but I'll turn it back over to you, Larry, or even Roz, in terms of the Paul Harvey, what's the rest of the story and the answer?
So we had three groups on this very simple case, and everybody seemed to be thinking alike, and everybody's in agreement about direction. Boy, this was simple. Raza, you want to give us kind of a sense of,
yeah.
I think there's two issues. One, the closure on the specifics of this case, but also each group very interestingly opened up a whole avenue of issues, different issues, all important issues. Raza?
No, I think this group kind of nailed it. Michael's comments were super helpful and spot on. The board did have to wrestle with employment issues. They weren't as severe in the end, you know, were worked out. That particular executive session was a tipping point where the lost board member representing Common, who had some background with Jane, and was actually instrumental in bringing her on, kind of got won over. The board at that executive session really did not see a way out of this. You know, they had partly COVID to blame things on, but partly to really know that we had hired the wrong CEO. This board collectively wasn't responsible for hiring her, or had not. They became board members later when the Series R happened. But that executive session did crystallize these things. The board at that time thought, if we cannot find another CEO who has expertise, will be able to, you know, bring it somewhere and successfully fundraise, then we really don't have any option but to shut this down. The board still, at this point, believe truly that the IP, the technology has value. They were enamored with, although again controversial, but the approval of the Biogen drug for Alzheimer, and thought that early detection would become really important as maybe even more drugs get approved and something can be done about it. They've really thought that joint ventures, licensing, strategic partnership for the assets could also be a viable option. The board did then, and it almost is luckily, I would say, found a really strong candidate, somebody who has done a similar company before, and seemed very capable. The board knew that person for the last decade or so, and did actually first line up the new CEO. And then, to Michael's point, really had to do very careful, tight, and choreographed maneuvering for essentially like the firing meeting with Jane. She did not take it very well. The board gave her about 72 hours to think on the two or three options that the board presented to her. Resignation on her own, termination without cause, with various, financial packages associated with each, with her resigning on her own being the more the bigger package for her. She did ultimately take that option. The board did bring in then swiftly the new CEO. To Gay's term of passing the hat, the company did raise very quickly a pass the hat round to give the company another chunk of money for very specific goals as well in this case. So the company lived on. The goals were to run another small clinical trial to bring the sensitivity and selectivity data on the test to a better level that brings it at par with the state of art, to work on a $3 million grant. I think, John, your group pointed out for non-dilutive funding as another source of cash for the company, and has specific goals on partnership and joint ventures with larger players such as Biogen to take this somewhere. So the company has lived on, and we'll see what actually happens. But from that particular board meeting that you were, or executive session that you guys were part of, so far, this has transpired since then.
So as a board member of this company, what are the lessons learned that can be applied in other situations?
I think the biggest lesson for us actually was that we did not diligence the CEO. We did not get to diligence the CEO, and the Series R was, an investor standpoint, and the board members were among the investors that became board members. It was just at that time super attractive terms, and we kind of were blinded by that in some ways. The board did actually find very early, once the round was announced, somebody contacted the board and said, "Hey, did you know she sued me for, they were like, "Oh, this is what you're going to do." But, we had early signs. But I think the biggest lesson is that in these recaps, turnarounds, you still got to do the diligence and not be, like the most attractive part was, hey, this is a company that has 30 million or plus gone into it. And you're getting it for 3 million. So it's like, wow, that's a bargain asset and very attractive round. And investors were kind of like not doing their full diligence on it.
Okay. Any other comments from anybody here about this case, or if you've been involved in something kind of similar to it?
And maybe the secondary lessons was like the you know, the boil the frog kind of problem. It's basically for the board, and in this particular case, part of it was COVID and put on COVID and was real as well. Like, yeah, work stopped and, you know, progress stopped, and the FDA was just really busy in the all the COVID things, and even their breakthrough designation took much more time than what the original goal was. So the secondary lesson was like, yeah, the boil the frog. So you got to make the call like sooner, saying, yeah, this is not really going anywhere. Maybe the second bridge round was a good hint.
Okay. Anybody else?
Larry, one of the things that kept in discussion for our team was, okay, the board had directed the CEO to do something and the CEO didn't do it. And there was some discussion about, well, does the CEO have to take direction from the board? And the other side was, well, the board directed the CEO to do something, the person didn't do it, that should be grounds for termination or lack of trust. So does the board have the rights to order the CEO, and does the CEO have to take orders from the board? Those are sort of discussion items.
Anybody in the room have an opinion about that?
The only difference here than what we had in the breakout room was Raza made very clear that the board members are also owners. That changes the game dramatically. Were they not owners, I stand by my assessment.
Okay.
And the only other thing I would add is whoever wrote the agreement for employment to begin with was not doing their job for the company. So that was a big issue. Forget about diligence and all the other stuff. Even if we did all the right things, that agreement still was not well written, and that was detrimental to our position in the end.
I think in the end, the general lesson though is when success happens, you know, all of these things would have been forgiven or not even come up. But when success doesn't happen, that, I mean, whatever, the, you know, who's swimming without the trunks when the tide goes down kind of problem. So in some ways, these startups, these science-based ventures are inherently risky. They're different than operating businesses and the boards that take over. And there is risk that the bugs are not going to like the science is not going to play out, the drug is not going to work, the data is not going to be good, and so on. So in another way, we investors kind of know that. That's what we're investing in, high-risk companies. So, you know, the lesson to unlearn there is, yeah, like there's so much you can do with these things. And when they don't work out, you see these kind of, you know, nasty things.
I would just have one follow-up question to the question. I believe it was John that asked. There's a lot of wisdom here from my perspective of being one of the new people to the group. Our discussion, though, I thought it would be great to get opinions on. Is the CEO bound to non-owner board members' directions and has to obey, as we discussed? Those are some big words in our group, right? Or is it such that there's a collaboration or partnership and each group does what he or she feels, assuming collaboration is broken down? Does the CEO have to obey the order of the board, or does she, setting this particular situation aside, if there were opinions of, is the CEO bound to follow the orders of the board, or perhaps not?
I mean, the board is not the CEO's manager, like manager in the word of like, you know, like assigning tasks. And it is kind of like really weird. In some ways, the board is not day-to-day managing. In fact, we want to have always the, you know, fingers out, nose in kind of philosophy on this. If the board says, yeah, we think you should talk with strategics, and here's one, let me connect you to Johnson & Johnson, whatever. And the CEO doesn't, well, says, yep, I'm on it, you know, but no, just practically doesn't do it eventually. That becomes a little different. Like, I mean, that's where kind of like the boil the frog thing, like these things are presented in retrospect saying, oh, once we look back, they were like, oh, that's what's going on. At that time, it's like the paradigm, it's not the paradigm of follow the orders or is the CEO following, because the board is not issuing orders. Like, I mean, sometimes it is, but like in general, not issuing order. We're helping with strategy, direction. Hey, let's try this. Let's do this. And so on. So I think it's a fair question, like how tight that, you know, follow the order paradigm is with the board.
I don't know. The roles that I've been CEO, and it's been CEO of a private equity company, a public company, you know, a family owned business. And I was, most of those cases, I was on the board as well. It was clear to me, my boss was the chairman of the board, you know, in the end.
So. And maybe another perspective to add to this, investor backed boards, oftentimes, if I make an odd number of five, should hopefully have a composition of two common, two representing preferred and owners, and one independent that's mutually acceptable to both. In this case, there was that present. However, the common were, I should say, more aligned with the CEO as they were part of the science and, you know, had that, you know, founder or co-founder mentality, and were the longest to come around to like, hey, the CEO is not working.
Raza, it sounds like the CEO has some successes early on with some of the, you know, things she came in and did and change and development and those types of things. So it sounds like she was getting some early successes. Were there any milestone misses or things that rose to the board's level that maybe should have been earlier indicators of trouble?
Yeah. In fact, the milestone missing is what, you know, little by little added up to this meeting and this, you know, realization. These do include, again, the FDA breakthrough designation work that should have been done, you know, much quicker and so on. Again, a little bit excuse there for COVID. Fundraising actually was the biggest. The original Series R had a very clear goal of doing some cleanup, reorging, you know, reconfiguring the assets and going and raising a certain amount. And the misses on those, you know, progress on those raises it meant that you have to raise another bridge for another chunk of money to get you another 6 months, and then another bridge to get you another 6 months, and so on. And so the missing of milestone or the, you know, very clear goal for the CEOs of fundraising was the biggest contributor to that.
Raza, on that, I was actually confused on the capital plan coming in, because for a life science company, that small amount of capital with the timeline, especially in the FDA, were there clear milestones that were linked to what would achieve a successful raise? And that we had this amount of time and we had enough capital to actually do that? Or were we guilty of iterating our way there and setting ourselves up for failure on the capital size from the get?
Yeah, I think there were clear goals on what achieves that raise or what Jane needed to accomplish in terms of like technical work and progress milestones on the science. I think it was just the combination of not making progress on those that was resulting in not being able to successfully raise.
So loss of credibility, missing dates and goals.
It all added up, but slowly.
Roz, I'm wondering in retrospect, thinking about lessons learned, whether, you know, to Robert's comment earlier, do you think that the level of board oversight, and I use the word oversight, not management, of course, but oversight was sufficient as sort of, you know, as these events cascaded, you know, if you guys had to do it all over again.
Yeah. I think the board does share part of the, you know, let's call it blame, in being a little slow in recognizing these things. However, you know, again, it's those two factors of the slow of the boil, you know, the frog being boiled slowly, and COVID that ended up in the sequence of events. Like if it was a normal, regular company and times, I think this was actually a very experienced board and should be much quicker to recognize and take mitigating actions. But just, you know, it was one thing after the other. So, okay, well, all right, we'll do the bridge and see where it goes. There are legit reasons why this thing doesn't happen, apparently.
Robert Johnson raised his hand. Robert?
Thanks, Larry. Yeah, what struck me, and I don't understand the life sciences industry very well, so please clarify. They burned through a lot of money to bring something to market that never really got to market. And I had two concerns. One is they'd been at this for 10 or 15 years. And maybe that's a life cycle of ultimately bringing something to market, assuming there's a market there.
Yeah.
And then the other is, hard to know what the turnover with employees and so forth, but my worry is if these folks were all part of the problem, then were they going to be part of a solution going forward, assuming I could get more money? And those were a couple of things that struck me as worrisome. But Raza, maybe you can comment. Yeah.
So Robert, I mean, the first comment I'll make, this is actually pretty normal in life sciences, as in going through so many years and so much money and then failing. I think the average cost to get one FDA drug approved has now reached $1.8 billion. People have coined the term for that. People know this thing called Moore's Law, which is the, you know, computing power doubles every 18 months. And this is the reverse of Moore's Law, which is Eroom's Law, that the cost of getting an FDA drug approved doubles every 18 months, so to speak. And a lot of that is cost of failure. We simply do not know about human disease and biology enough. And these are all things being tried. Like this is a general overarching comment on life science, therapeutics, drug discovery, medical devices in general. Particular to this company was also the same. This asset, you know, when they took 30 plus million with the a famous family office and a big name conglomerate, it was all, you know, in some ways you can put it on, you know, mismanagement and all of those things. But the end also is the science and the data wasn't as exciting for others to pick. These are things where in life science, people take quantums of risk. Hey, let's bring it to animal data and somebody else buys you. And then let's bring it to clinical trial phase one and somebody buys you on that safety data. It just didn't work out is, you know, a polite way of saying that the science didn't work. However, the Series R investors did feel like, oh, there's still enough interesting data and things here that we could recap it and, you know, give it another go. And so this story, then this is how it played out with the series R. R stands for recap, and how that went down and is here today.
I would like to, at this point, thank Raza very much for his participation and writing the case. And again, I want to encourage you to take a look at Joe Ayoub and Raza's podcast called On Boards, plural, O-N-B-O-A-R-D-S podcast, onboardspodcast.com. So thank you, Raza, very much. We're pleased to have Robert Blackburn as here today. And Robert is going to be presenting a case next month on the last Tuesday, not the last Thursday, but the last Tuesday of the month. Tomorrow, if everything goes well, you'll be getting an invitation to Robert's case. I just want to clarify what happened to me, because it may happen to you. When I started this call, on my screen, after the apps, there was END, end, and there was nothing called more, and I couldn't start the Zoom. I couldn't get the Zoom rooms going. Suddenly, in the middle of your talking, the more section appeared, and all the controls are in the more section. So I think this may be one of the things that if you're starting Zoom for the first time after this new version, you may just look for the more next to apps, but if it doesn't appear, it'll come later on. So on that note, I want to thank you very much for your participation. We look forward to seeing you next month when Robert is giving the case.
Thank you very much.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Thanks, Raza. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bill Asher, nice to see you.